This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo. And it is no secret that Malaysia's population is already an aging one, and it's a slope that we are simply just continuing to hurtle down. But, you know, for years we've been discussing, or we've heard that a senior citizens bill to protect the rights and welfare of older adults has been in the works. It has been discussed and debated quite extensively, of course, outside of Parliament, but nothing concrete has yet to be presented or tabled to Parliament as such. But now with, you know, growing financial burdens following the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, and increasing concerns over abandonment of older adults as well, who shoulders the responsibility of caring for the older population? You know, what is the status of older adults here in Malaysia? So joining me to discuss today's topic is Chai Senting, Senior Research Officer at the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging, also known as My Aging, at University Putra, Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Chai. How are you doing today?
Hi, Soed.
We're talking about this because of another recent news about abandonment of older adults, Chai. You know, recently the government noted that more than 2,000 senior citizens were abandoned at hospitals from 2018 to June this year. They've said that they've reunited some of them with family members, but more than 1,200 of them were completely alone with no family members to be found. But, you know, this is very specific to the hospital setting, right? How concerning is this number to you? And what does this tell us about the issue of abandonment of older adults in Malaysia?
Well, first and foremost, I think for many geriatricians and doctors at the public hospitals, this is definitely not something new, as you have said. Perhaps the biggest concern even back then was what we call bed hogging. You know, in the sense that when the elderly was brought in with various problems, after treatment, you know, they can go home or they can return to the care center. But many of the elderly were not picked up by family members, you know, just because maybe they felt that the hospital is a safer environment for these elderly to recuperate. But that's not really what the public hospital beds are for. So some step-down care was actually proposed, and there is a need for more and more facilities, you know, nursing homes where they can recuperate if they could not get suitable carers at home. So these are some of the existing situations that has been gradually worsening over the years. So, of course, some might take issue with the definition of abandonment, and we are quick to use that label, actually. When we talk about elderly in charitable homes, we also talk about abandonment, you know, so there's really no good way anybody can go anywhere without being stuck with that label. So I suppose, yes, there are some very clear-cut cases where elder abuse, neglect and maltreatment is happening. Elder abandonment is part of that construct. But I think we just have to be a little bit more careful when we use such terms. But definitely we can say that when an elderly needs help, when an elderly needs services and they are not getting them, it is a form of abandonment by expected next of kin who are supposed to provide such services or such assistance. But we have reached a stage where it's probably more helpful for us to think about what can be done to address these vulnerability issues or these what we call gaps in care that's happening in our society at the moment.
You know, it's not always a black and white issue, right? When we talk about abandonment, we need to consider the circumstances that the older adult is in. What are the, I guess, different factors that could contribute to a situation where an older adult finds themselves, you know, unable to access the services that they need?
I think this is a question of both provisions, availability of services, but at the same time also life arrangements. This is an example. We talk about clear abandonment in these cases. They say, oh, they left the elderly at a hospital. Mm-hmm. So it's a form of abandonment. But we actually don't talk about how we leave many elderly in the rural areas to fend for themselves without family members or social support. And when frailty sets in, you know, the aging elderly in rural areas are technically abandoned as well because they are far away from services, they do not get help. So it all depends on how we frame the issue. There are very clear-cut cases of abandonment, for example, where somebody was just being dropped off in a rural area or somewhere near a coffee shop, you know, and they say that, you know, we'll come back for you, and they don't come back. So we have cases like that as well. So it's just a question of how do we figure out social services or social support and caregiving services to help families to take care of their elderly family members. I think in the case of bed hoggers or abandonment at hospital wards, you know, that they didn't come and pick them up, there could be other factors where medical caseworkers or social workers need to look into. And this is, I think, where precisely the Department of Social Welfare and the Ministry of Health is trying to play their role.
Mm. So there's a need to also understand why adult children are doing so in the first place, right? So that we know for sure what the needs of the older adults are, what has led to that situation, to them being left to fend for themselves.
Yes, we hardly talk about elderly abandonment beyond the context of filial piety or family responsibility. But as you might be aware, there are more and more elderly who are not married or they are childless or their children are overseas. So mm-hmm. in such situations, you know, it is really debatable how are we going to regulate this across the board, you know, without looking at individual cases and also, of course, the life histories and trajectories of such elderly and their relationship with their family members. You know, it's not a coincidence that we have cases where the elderly, they are not unmarried, they have children, but their relationship is in such bad straits that they do not talk to each other, they have no longer been in contact for years. So where do we start working on such cases?
Hmm. This isn't a new problem, right? So what is the holdup? Why do you think we aren't seemingly taking the welfare of older adults more seriously?
I think it's always a question about whose responsibility it is. And you ask right clearly that, oh, is it the state or is it the families or is it the children? But I think we all know that for those who are still able to plan for themselves, it always starts with you. We start with ourselves. You know, self-care is probably the most important first step. And we have to make provisions for our own old age and age care. But when you reach a stage where you are already old and infirm and you need support, then the state has a responsibility to make sure that such provisions are accessible, they are available, and they are affordable. That's perhaps the most important point. I mean, we have many, many aged care services and facilities in this country, but for most of the time, that is actually out of the reach of the common folk. So that's where the state has to step in to create provisions, to create options for the B40 or for the middle class so that they do have services and facilities that they can afford and use for themselves and their family members.
Hmm. All right. We'll dive more into what the state can do as well as some other solutions that have been put forth by others. After a quick break, I'm speaking today to Chai Sen Ting, Senior Research Officer at the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging at Universiti Putra Malaysia. And we're talking about whose responsibility is it to care for the older adult population, especially as Malaysia is already an aging one. We'll be right back after a quick break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Su. And on the show with me today is Chai Senting, Senior Research Officer at the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging at University Putra, Malaysia. And we are talking about the responsibility to care for the older adult population. And this is coming off recent reports that, you know, we are seeing a significant number of older adults being abandoned in hospitals. And of course, we're broadening that discussion to look at how we're caring for the older adults in our population as a whole. You know, Chai, one of the solutions that was brought up to address this issue was, and this was something that you brought up earlier, was our reliance on filial piety, right? There has been suggestions that this should be something that we mandate, perhaps, you know, that it should be made into law that children look after their parents, similar to Singapore's Maintenance of Parents Act, you know, because this is such a huge part of our culture, right, of our traditional values. But do you think that enshrining it in law will improve the welfare of older adults?
I think Singapore's Parental Maintenance Act is a very specific piece of legislation. It talks about enabling parents to get maintenance support, or in the case we are talking about financial support from the children. You can't really mandate care, but you can probably mandate some form of a financial support. That's the outline of the Singapore's law. China or India tried pass similar legislation. Theirs is even more all-encompassing, in the sense that they try and even regulate that the children have to take care of the elderly, you know, by bringing them to live together and all sorts of acts of filial piety. But I think we can't legislate our way out of this problem. But of course, it's always good to have a law that can be used. Actually, in the Sharia enactments in several states, the provisions of nafkah is actually made available for elderly Muslim parents to actually tuntutan nafkah from their children. It's just that in the civil law, we do not have such a piece of legislation. I do believe that it serves a purpose, but it's not going to really address the issue of elderly abandonment in hospitals. That is not going to solve that, because simply put, the Parents Maintenance Act is something that what we call it is actually more of a tribunal form of approach where you know you try to adjudicate. It's not really a legal case per se in that way, because you're talking about intergenerational relationships over long periods of time, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, a lifetime, essentially. And when the court steps in, the court can help if there is actually some evidence of neglect, some evidence of abandonment, and the children actually can afford to care for their parents and has the obligation to do so. So they try and compensate in a form of financial support. You cannot really regulate a relationship. No more you can get a couple to talk to one another through legal means. So similarly, when you use law and you use legislation to provide care for senior citizens, this is a very limited approach. There are many, many things that we can do. Law, enacting and legislating new laws is just one of them. We do need new laws, by the way. We do need laws that specifically cater to elder abuse, neglect and maltreatment. We do need laws that can provide caregiver support and relief. We can have all that, but none of it will be a silver bullet, unfortunately.
So considering that a lot of older adults have significant health challenges, right, that comes with cost, and financing elderly care is costly, whether you're doing it from your own pocket or through the public health system, that still comes out of the government's pocket. You know, and of course, we've heard that many people have exhausted their retirement savings, if they had any, after COVID-19, right, because of the financial difficulties. So how can the government improve that financial support, or how can the government support adult children to help them, you know, support the older adults in their family?
I think the most important thing to consider about is our approach to the national social protection system. And we don't talk about it enough because in the minds of many, it's still tied to employment. For many people talk about retirement, it's always tied into my employment. Mm-hmm. But we are talking about housewives. We're also talking about people who do not have stable careers throughout their adulthood. So if we talk about our national social protection system, there's still a lot of reforms that could be had to make it more equitable, to make it fairer for everyone. And that's the conversation that we probably need to have more, to talk about equitable ways to make sure that everyone has some kind of a income in old age. You know, we are not necessarily talking about giving everyone a pension, but we could be talking about under existing labor market structures, under our current occupational savings plan or pension plan, what are the things that we can do to reform the social protection system so that it becomes more equitable and sustainable for Malaysians? A very good example is that we have always talked about the Bantuan Orang Tua or the Old Age Assistance Scheme, 500 ringgit a month, you know, and our only real major improvements is to keep increasing the quantum. But we hardly pause and ask ourselves that, you know, why 500? Why 350? Why even 1,000? Why a fixed sum? You know, that's something that we rarely ask ourselves. And we say that, you know, different households have different needs. Some might be poorer than the other, but our quantum of aid is fixed. Mm-hmm. So that is something that's very peculiar. Maybe in the early days it's for administrative purposes, you know, it's much easier. But nowadays where targeting is much easier, it's actually easier to assess all your records, you can actually do a better job at assessing gaps in needs and wants. So there's really very little reason for us to stick to old ways of doing things and think about maybe some families deserve more help than the other. You know, maybe we all just need one Bantuan Keluarga Malaysia and that's it. We just increase or reduce the quantum based on a family's need or how far they variate from the national average. You know, that could be a better way to think about how we deliver assistance and support. But we are not seeing that yet. We are still looking at very, what we call administratively viable solutions rather than truly addressing the needs of the poor and especially the elderly who have no income. So I think that that's some room for improvement there for sure for us as a country.
Mm. You know, targeted aid is always said to be the best form, right? Because you're looking at who needs aid the most. But do you think that we have that ability to accurately or sufficiently assess the different and you know, decide, you know, what are the different needs between different families or different individuals?
I believe maybe 10, 20 years ago when this question is posed, it will always be said that mean testing or targeted mechanisms are very costly. But lessons from countries like Australia, especially what they did with TargetLink and all these linking up of big data in their respective administrative systems, we are looking at a future where we have to make some trade-offs, even for census, even for major surveys. A lot of people felt that, you know, wow, it's so costly, and yet we only do it once every 10 years. Mm-hmm. The information is in doubt. The quality of the data is... But let's look at it on the other side of the coin. You know, data and information is very, very critical today. And we can actually look at countries like Netherlands where they no longer do a 10-year census. They still carry out censuses for pocket populations. But they actually have all this information in their population registry. Indonesia has Kartu Keluarga, China and the East Asian states, they all have some form of a household registry. We have IC. You know, we have the National Registration Department. So we already have the data, to be precise. In fact, if you are working, you have income, you already have a file with the LHDN or the Inland Revenue Board. If you have low income and you don't pay taxes, your data and information would already be in SOCSO, you know, under the Social Security Organization, the death and injury benefits insurance. So KWSP, another trove of data. So the question here now is, you know, we call this statecraft, you know, how much are we willing to actually utilize what we already have for a better common targeting system so that you don't have to keep jumping through the hoops over and over again. When you need assistance, you do a mean testing. You don't have to do that. Once you're done, you know, your records are linked up and it is accessible. You know, a common targeting mechanism means that once in, you are already identified as B40 or B20 or B10. And there's really no need for you to jump through any more hoops of mean testing and all that. So the question here is, are we making use of the information technology that we have, the tools that we have, to actually cut through all these red tape? You know, different organizations, different departments will do their own mean testing. So maybe those days should be put behind us and we should have some form of a common targeting mechanism.
It's not necessarily about coming up with something new, right? It's about looking at what we have and how we can improve upon that so that we can provide aid in a more efficient way. And then are you concerned that there would be people who would fall through the cracks?
I believe that that is always the reason why we have the social welfare department and all the various government agencies, so that when someone or some households or families do fall through the cracks, and this is where they come in, you know, to play their part. What we have to be aware about is that the information around us and the data around us is sufficient to help us have proper targeting mechanisms. It's there. The information is there. When you buy a car, when you buy a house, all this information is transacted and recorded. Banking details, information, CTOR, CCRIS. So what we are really lacking here is actually, first of all, what we call data security. That's our main technical challenge, to make sure that we have proper data security when all this information is linked up. And then the second thing is, think about different ways how this data connectivity or personal data connectivity can be put to a greater good. For example, when we talk about targeted subsidies, I'm sure the government is talking about targeted subsidies nowadays, about the high cost of fuel and all that. But there are many other ways we can actually achieve the same result without resorting to very convoluted processes of identifying who is a poor household. It can be actually easily done. We have all this data. The question here is that the data are sitting, this administrative data are sitting with the respective government entities and they don't speak to one another. So if we can have a mechanism like Centrelink, like what's happening in Australia, we can actually improve the targeting mechanism by many, many fold.
Now, what's part of this whole discussion about supporting older adults is also having a network of institutions or facilities, right? Particularly aged care facilities for those older adults who require such infrastructure, right? And of course, then comes in the discussion that, you know, older adults who can't take care of themselves or who don't have people to help them take care of themselves should be placed in welfare homes. How tenable is that solution?
I would not use the word welfare homes. Maybe I would use the word aged care facilities or aged care services, because it's not just about elderly who do not have family members to take care of them. Maybe they do, but perhaps their frailty or their health, mental health or physical health problems were so severe that the average family member could not cope, or they are not trained to provide such caregiving services. So I would say that our mentality has to change. That's for one, but also partially because in our side of the world, those who are paying for such services are usually the adult children. So in other countries, the elderly themselves paid for such services. You know, I want to go into a nursing home, I'll find myself a nice retirement village or whatsoever.
They make that decision.
Yeah, they make their own decision. I mean, it's their money. So and it's a very different thing when you are the clients rather than you are the, you know, your son or your daughter is paying for it, you know, and you can't really do anything. So I suppose these are the changes that will come. But the biggest issue here is the aged care industry something that we view positively? You know, just like how we look at childcare facilities, you know, kindergartens, nurseries, and all that. Of course, over here, because of historical baggage, you know, we have those, like you said, welfare, charitable, old folks' homes. So the whole industry is a little bit tied to that. You know, oh, yes, if you're staying in a facility, you must be abandoned. You know, that would be the highlight of the day. But the truth is that these are very costly facilities. And if you use nurses, trained nurses, registered nurses, the cost is really 4,000 or 5,000 ringgit a month easily. And this is where you have to think about, you know, is it something that everyone can afford? Or is that something that we should recommend? Because many developed countries are going away from institutionalization. It's possible to age in place, but you need a lot of facilities and services to help you age in place. So these are the new modalities that we have to look into and not say, we shouldn't send elderly to homes. It's a big no-no. But then, do you have alternatives? You want women to work. You want female labor force participation rate to go up. But who will then perform the traditional role of childcare and elder care? So something's got to give, you know, and this is some of the things that we do not think through when we try and promote different social goals, but we do not realize that at the same time, we want the family to take care of the elderly, but you're not giving the family the tools and the resources to do so. So that's something we have to think about.
Mm. Perception is one thing, right? And that has to involve us looking at caregiving work as work. It's not just another responsibility that you shoulder on. So what are some examples that you think the government can prioritise when it comes to strengthening our network of aged care facilities, right? Whether it's fully residential ones or perhaps more of those that are in the community. Because that is an area that Malaysia is struggling with, right? We don't have a strong network of such facilities.
Yeah, I think our long-term care industry, our aged care industry, is still young, maybe 10, 20 years old since the 1990s, where the private market really took off. I suppose it is always good for the government to take note that their role, you know, whether as regulator or as a funder, even if yours is a charity home, you still have to be accountable because the minimum quality of care should be equally applied regardless of whether you are a government home or a charity home or a private home. That should be always the case. So I assume that we still have a long way to go because we are still struggling with even basic registration and monitoring of such facilities. About 1,000 plus homes was vaccinated during the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet only about 400, less than 400 is actually licensed and registered. So 802 is there, the new acts are there. But I suppose the biggest issue here is not just about licensing and registration. That is the most minimum requirement. What we should be talking about is that we have a robust data on the number of beds available, what kind of beds, you know, because you cannot just say that having a bed for a disabled elderly or dependent elderly is the same as a independent elderly. So we need actually a lot of data and information to properly assess, you know, how well our aged care facilities and services. And we can then confidently say that, look, currently all our beds are institutionalized. We don't have community beds. We also don't have a very good door-to-door or what we call mobile-based services. We cannot make those claims because it's not that they aren't. There are many mobile service providers or home-based providers, carers, but we do not have sufficient industry data to describe the situation on the ground. And this is where it's very dangerous to make assumptions, especially when we come up with new laws or regulations. We must double-check our assumptions, you know, like they are probably very well-intentioned, good meaning towards all these, some of the actions to encourage children to take care of their parents. But if we are not careful, some of these laws or some of these programs might have the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. Some of the earliest lessons I remember when I started out working was that bantuan orang tua used to be given to elderly who live alone. they are not provided for elderly who stay with their family members, however poor they are. So it created a perverse situation where the elderly would report that they are living alone while they are not, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course, in recent years, since 2018, they have changed that based on findings from research. You know, these are the kind of things that we should ask and we should talk about, because it's not that they are bad laws or they are bad programs. It's just that we have to think, is that the mandate of the organization? iSuri, for example, you know, KWSP is a occupational savings plan. You know, it's a provident fund for working individuals. So where do we draw the line for institutions like EPF to look into the needs of housewives? So these are some of the things that we should ask and we can ask, but we are not given sufficient room to properly debate these issues in the public. And a lot of times, the details are only made known to us when it is already presented or when it is already written. So it creates a much more difficult walk back situation if some of it doesn't quite add up.
Consultation with people who are already involved with the research, right? With stakeholders, that's what really matters, because you guys would know what is best, what is needed. So then, you know, Chai, if we do one day see the senior citizens, if we do one day see the senior citizens bill being presented or drafted in some form or other, what do you think should be the priorities to be covered, or you know, what should it avoid?
I think in any legislation or program or policy, there has to be a balance of points of view. You know, in a sense, it's not just the experts that matter. It's also the lay people, the NGOs, the private businesses. So, of course, the expectations for any new law is high, because we all have a tendency to hope for a silver bullet or a law that can solve our problems. But I think we need to be realistic. When the new law is being tabled, it's good to listen and see, you know, what areas does it cover? Is it something that is redundant or overlap with existing legislation? And more importantly, perhaps, we can see whether it's actually enforceable. That those are the critical criteria of evaluating any new piece of law. You know, is it enforceable? Is it does it make sense? Is there sufficient funding? So these are some of the concerns. But of course, lawmaking is a long process. You know, they can present a bill. There'll be debates, first reading, second reading, and in between. Hopefully, everybody has a chance to go through the details and chip in their ideas. Mm-hmm. So who knows? It's always a work in progress. You know, that's why we have the parliamentarians and the lawmakers.
So to wrap up our discussion, Chai, you know, what do you think? What do you want listeners to take away when it comes to, I guess, the responsibility of caring for older adults?
I think there is a reason why some social phenomena happen. You know, the bed hogging at public hospitals, they are indicative of larger problems. You know, they're indicative of problems where the elderly probably couldn't get sufficient care, especially in low-income households. This is actually a red flag that's actually trying to be getting our attention for many years now. We have income tax rebates, but what if you are not rich enough to enjoy that rebate? And you are not poor enough at the same time to qualify for financial assistance. So the government has to think about these gaps. You know, this is what we are here for. You know, there's nothing wrong with the existing incentives. It probably works well, but maybe some groups, you know, are left out. You know, they are neither here nor there. So we always say that the cost of healthcare, the cost of medication. But we do know that the public healthcare system for the elderly is actually extremely generous in the region. So the issue there probably is congestion or awareness or lack of awareness. So we have to look into different social phenomena and ask ourselves why some things are happening to certain families and certain households. Then we can think about the right response. You know, putting out blanket solutions or setting very difficult to verify conditions probably is not going to help. But there are always proxies and ways we can actually reach out to vulnerable groups. And I suppose that's why I hope with the review of the national policy for the elderly, older persons plan of action, we can take into consideration the new realities, you know, in a post-pandemic environment. And we have to change the way we actually do things. You know, in every crisis, there's always opportunity for us to rethink how best to address a problem.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Chai.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking to Chai Senting, Senior Research Officer at the Malaysian Research Institute on Aging at Universiti Putra Malaysia, and we've been discussing the issue of abandonment of older adults and more importantly, you know, the need to take responsibility to better support and care for our older population. I'm Lim Suen, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.